Yeah, Wednesday. What's up? Welcome in. It's Grant and Danny. Danny's vacation in Scotland continues. Toby Altizer is in and alongside. You are locked into the Fan, and we will take you up to 6:15 this evening and the pregame ahead of Nationals baseball. Got a double play for you at 3:45 and a blitz at 4 o'clock today. It was a significant day for the Commanders. Joint practice, an important milestone in their preseason. They have a game now 2 days away on Friday night, Toby. We are closing in on game action. But officially, the NFL season kicked off for me yesterday with episode number one of Hard Knocks. I watched the Buffalo Bills, first of four episodes here this August, last evening. Did you get to watch episode one yet?
I did. It was awesome. It was so good.
It's going to be great. They know what they're doing. They're just feeding ice cream to someone who really enjoys sugar and cold, delicious treats. So here are my takeaways from Hard Knocks episode one, in case you missed it pretty briefly. No spoilers here, but the Bills are one of five teams that still go away for training camp.
I love that, by the way.
Every team should do this.
Mm-hmm.
There is a nostalgia to it from my childhood. When I was 10 years old, the then Redskins went to Frostburg. That was what they did back then. That's Darius's alma mater, in fact. And they would go to the mountains of Frostburg, and they would have training camp every year. And the first training camp I ever went to at 10 years old was in Frostburg. And so you see the guys riding their bikes around this little mountain town and going in and out of the little shops where people are hanging out that are going to training camp the next morning and interacting with players. And it's,
yeah, speaking of ice cream,
quaint and cool. Yeah. Carlisle, actually, which is the place that they had training camp probably for the longest in Pennsylvania, Dickinson College. I went there for Marty Schottenheimer's training camp. Only time that during, you know, my time around the team over the last 26, 27 years that they were in Carlisle. But they had this very famous ice cream parlor where all the players would go for their like late night treat after practice and meetings. And all the fans knew if you go there, you're going to see some players. And it was a cool thing. The mingling, you saw it last night where the Bills have a place like this. They go away to Rochester. It's about 75 miles away, I think, from Buffalo where they are. They're at this little college that has nice football turf and football fields. They sleep in dorm rooms on dorm beds, but they hook them up. These are big guys, so they put two beds together and they put a nice mattress over top. I mean, we're far enough along in sports science now to know that guys need to be able to sleep well. So they're not asking them to sleep on a twin bed that some, you know, 127-pound freshman is going to be sleeping on a month from now. But the going away for camp is just a lost relic in football. The fact that only five teams do it is such a sad thing to hear. But that would be the first thing I did if I took over here. And they're running a good program. Adam Peters and Dan Quinn know what they're doing. They don't need to listen to me. But the first change I would make, GM Paulson, we are going away. I don't care if it's Carlisle or Frostburg or we'll find a new place, but we are packing up shop. We're headed to the mountains, and we are going to build the brotherhood with no distractions together, locked in arms for weeks.
I think they're like staying at a team hotel during training camp.
They do, yeah.
So at least there's a little bit of that, but still, the comforts of home, being around home, you can always go. There's just a missing camaraderie aspect when you can just go home for the evening.
So then that's the other thing. And I don't know specific to Dan Quinn. I'd have to ask about this, but back when I was on the beat and they did this in Ashburn, they would train at the facility. They have now, dating back to like 2000 roughly, almost every year, other than when they went to Richmond for a few years. Richmond, at least they went away, but it was still different because, you know, it's very, you know, urban downtown in the city, but at least it went away. It was comparable. I'm talking about, though, going to like a college, sleeping in a dorm room, you know, doing it that way, I think. The way grandpa did it, the way dad did it, it was good enough for them. It's good enough for me. But they did stay at the hotel, but it was very kind of written in pencil. Like if you are old enough, if you're a veteran, you could go home. Don't worry. Hey, you got a baby at home. Don't worry. You could be there. There's no like real rules about it. And I don't know if that's how they do it now or if it is a little bit more serious that you got to be in the hotel every single night. That would be good. But just get away from the rat race, man. Get out of the area. Frankly, I know this will go over poorly with some people. Get away from your family and whatever distractions there are for, it's not like camp's 30 days anymore. It used to be.
No, I mean, even they mention in Hard Knocks, 2.5 weeks that they're going to be there.
We're talking about 12 days or something like that that you're going away. Get out of town. I love it. There's also just this ability to connect with fans that happens when you do that. Because fans are going for their vacation, and they're there 3 or 4 days in a row. And when players are going around campus on scooters, they're all on their little scooters. Like, there's just neat little interactions, which is point number two I want to bring up from my Hard Knocks takeaways. I've always felt like the relationship between the fans and the Bills exceeds that of most teams. I don't know what it is. It feels almost like a fan-team relationship from a bygone era. There is this love, this very like positive optimism. I think it's the town, honestly. Buffalo is not a big media market. There's not a lot going on there. Like, they had a minor league baseball team at one point. But I think they have wings in the Bills. Like, that's kind of, you know, Maryland is crab cakes and football. Buffalo is chicken wings and Josh Allen. Like, that's what they do. That's what those are their exports. But there's just something about what I perceive to be a harmonious back and forth. It's not just a one-way fans love the team. Like, you could see it. The Bills have this reverence for their fans. The Bills Mafia, they think of them as the best fan base. Every team says we've got the best fans. I truly believe the Bills think they have the best fans, and you can see it in their interactions with the fans.
100%. It feels college-like, and it's different from some colleges where, and you think about just down south a little bit with Carolina, where North Carolina's right there, Duke's right there, so you have your allegiances. And so there's a love for your team, but kind of a hate for another team.
Yep.
With Bills Mafia, everybody in the area doesn't really care about anybody else. It's just about Buffalo. So all the love, all the hatred, there's no hatred. It's all focused on just loving one thing, which is the Buffalo Bills. And it's so cool to see, because there are plenty of fan bases that love teams like that. But like you said, seeing the Bills players kind of have that same affection back to the fan base, it's really cool to see that mix. I think it's led by Josh Allen, though, where he just admires that fan base so much. He's such a good guy, and seeing his interaction. But really, it's everybody. It's so cool to see that connection, which you don't see in professional sports much anymore.
There's an aura around that fan base, too, whether it's the jumping through tables or, you know, running through fire, or the, you know, eating bricks, or all of the dumb stuff they do before games and when they kick off.
Well, and part of it, too, I think, is maybe it's just going through the lifestyle up there, where we've seen before where dudes get snowed in and they're like, hey, you want to hop on my snow machine and we'll drive you down to the facility?
This is what I'm saying. I mean, they'll, on days where there's a foot of snow and they're playing, like, some random dude named Earl will just go scoop up the Bills offensive line on his snowmobile.
Yeah,
we'll get you to the stadium. By the way, I've been to what is now the final year of that stadium in Orchard Park. They're building the new beautiful facility right next door, which we saw them building on Hard Knocks last night. Josh Allen took a tour with the owner. But you pull up to that stadium, it looks like a high school stadium, because it's mostly in the ground, more than any other NFL stadium that I've seen. And so it looks pretty tiny. Like, you're driving up on it in the parking lot, and you're like, oh, this has to be an awesome high school facility. Like, no, this is where the Bills play. Like, how is this big enough for an NFL stadium? Well, most of it, it's a bowl in the ground, essentially. So I'm looking forward that this one's a little more vertical, goes straight up. It doesn't seem nearly as in the ground, this place that's basically in the parking lot.
But I tell you what, I'm mad because I don't think that there's any chance that I'll be able to go this year, but it was a bucket list to go to a Bills game when it was snowy and it was just terrible conditions.
You should go. I mean, but this one will be no different. I mean, the wind and the cold is going to be a little less, so if you just wanted to be uncomfortable in the weather.
I enjoy the bit of, like, all right, we're going to go in and we're going to shovel this thing out. The next day, we're going to go watch a football game and throw snowballs at each other.
Well, they're still going to do that.
Love that.
The new stadium will have that, too. The only difference is going to be that they've designed it, and they talked about this in Hard Knocks. I don't know how the science works on this, but they've basically done all of the work and the math now to figure out how to cut down on wind. So they have one stadium position just so, with these like windows that open. And I mean, the tech now, I can't wait to see what the Commanders do here. Because just in the few conversations I've had with their people behind the scenes on the money they're spending on trying to figure out even like where ride sharing is going. Because it's going to be critical for them in D.C. with only 8,000 parking spots to crush it with ride sharing. Well, we know right now what that looks like. But the stadium opens in 2030. 5 years from now, it's going to look very different. So they're trying to get ahead of the curve on those type of things. For the Bills, their biggest bullet point when they were, you know, if you're buying a house, my wife's like, we need a multi-car garage. Okay. She needs, you know, I need to make sure the washer dryer is on the same level as this. like the Bills' number one prerequisite was not the two-car garage. It was the wind not ruining their games. And what's funny is in the short term, you almost want the wind to ruin your games because Josh Allen's got the strongest arm in the league and he can throw the ball through the wind and the opposing quarterback probably can't. But he's not going to be around for the 100 years of that stadium or however long, you know, 50, 60 years you're playing. So after the next 12 years of Josh Allen, you're probably not going to have his arm on your next quarterback.
Yeah, I just enjoyed how many games you'd see in Buffalo. It felt like at least one a year where it's like, yep, they're not throwing the football today. It's 30-mile-an-hour winds and snow. Like, you can't even see the field. Like, yep. I love that stuff. I know you're not necessarily the biggest fan of those games. But I love those games.
You mentioned Josh Allen, though. Josh Allen basically is going to get one big commercial about what a good guy and how awesome he is out of Hard Knocks. And this is why every single team should sign up for this. The commercial that is Bills football, that's what Hard Knocks has become now because the teams and the league is so heavily involved in the product that gets churned out. And this is not a complaint. I'm eating this up like it's potato chips with hell of a good dip on a Sunday at 1 o'clock. But why every team would not want to be a part of this, I'll never understand. You look at what it did for the Rex Ryan, Mark Sanchez Jets becoming, you know, an American institution for a couple of years in this beloved club. I still think the Lions benefit massively, Dan Campbell specifically,
100%.
From the cologne of Hard Knocks. I think you're going to see it with, you know, on the sideline with Sean McDermott. You're going to see it with this entire operation. But Josh Allen is so decent and so likable and seemingly, I mean, anything can make you look however it wants to, but I've always heard from everyone in the league, like one of the most genuine, awesome people. And the whole episode is just seeing Josh Allen, like legitimately he's signing autographs and a kid's like, it's my birthday. And it's as if like every kid that tells him that, he needs to make sure that their birthday gets special. I mean, he's just a great dude, it seems like. So I loved that. And then lastly, their big tackle, Deion Dawkins. Huge personality.
He is a character.
Huge human being. He goes out drifting. He like, think about the second version of, or was it the third version?
I can't help you out here.
Of Fast and the Furious. It was the one that doesn't count because it was a different cast and it was a bad movie. But Tokyo Drift, where you basically just like get in a car and then you slide on your tires sideways in a parking garage. He takes this car out. He's got his own team, and they go out and they just drift. But the best, funniest thing is he takes his four kids with him. These kids are all like between 2 and 5 years old. They buckle up. They put on a helmet. They ride shotgun as he just flies around in this car, drifting all over the place through barriers. I mean, what a wild dude that is.
It's absolutely incredible to watch. I can tell you one thing. If any of the Commanders are into that, please don't let me know because I'm going to be worried sick. That, like, as cool as it looks, as fun as it looks, it is still scary to see. I can imagine a Bills fan watching that like, I don't know if I want my franchise left tackle doing that, but he clearly understands what he's doing because it doesn't sound like that was his first rodeo.
Oh, no.
And there hasn't been any issues.
He literally said he does it every single day.
I can't imagine. It sounds like it's something that I wouldn't be interested in, but it looks incredibly cool.
He signed a 3-year, $60 million extension recently. I'm just surprised something like that's allowed to be in your contract. We see that guys aren't allowed to play basketball sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Mahomes had one highlight go around of him cooking a guy on the basketball court, and next day he's like, yeah, I can't play anymore.
Right. Jet skis or whatever. Yeah. Like, oh, cool, you want to just go slide around in a car at 100 miles an hour with your kids in the vehicle? No problem, dude. Just let us know when you're done. We'll get your pads back on you for you. But Hard Knocks Episode 1, fantastic. In the books, excited about it. I also checked out the new Netflix series on the SEC.
I haven't got a chance to watch this. I'm excited about it, though.
Yeah, I'm only halfway through episode one. This is going to be a longer burn because I think there's...
How many episodes are there?
It's got to be 8 or so, I would think.
Yeah.
It's a full series, but it's on the 2024 season. So the tough thing about this is, maybe someone would say this is a strength or it's good about these shows, but you forget everything that happened, right? So it is like, in some ways, you're remembering as you're watching, but it's tough when you're now in 2025 mode. Like, if this comes out 2 months ago, perfect. Right now, I'm still trying to figure out the depth chart of quarterbacks at South Carolina and LSU.
Yeah.
So now to get back into the 2024 season's complicated, but the behind the scenes and getting to see...
Do they show Vandy week one? Because I can skip that episode.
No. So far, we've gotten a lot of LSU and Brian Kelly.
Okay.
Who's a hard ass. I didn't realize, like, what a stickler that guy is.
Big time.
He is, like, I'm surprised in this era he can recruit like he does. I'm sure they just pay dudes a lot of money, but that guys don't transfer a lot, because you see right after that, Shane Beamer, Frank's son, Frank Beamer, of course, the Virginia Tech legend. Shane came up with Virginia Tech, bounced around a couple places, I think Oklahoma, Georgia, and now the head coach at South Carolina. And the juxtaposition right after meeting Brian Kelly, whose dad was like politics, military, mm-hmm. and like, yes, sir, no, sir. And then Shane Beamer, who's just your buddy. You know, he you have this closer than father-son relationship. It's like, okay, I see how this plays with 18-year-olds in 2025. And I can believe that that guy doesn't want to transfer. But those LSU players are getting screamed at all day long. Weird that he's never won a national title.
Well, and that's why when people were talking about how Jaden went from Arizona State to willingly going to a Brian Kelly-led system, that's what they're talking about. Like, it is militaristic in a lot of ways with Brian Kelly.
I think everybody's different in terms of what they want, how they want to be coached. I actually, maybe I'm in the minority, I would prefer a Brian Kelly. I like the idea of being really, truly coached. You know what I mean? Like, even in radio, right? We have a boss who's supportive and gives us whatever we need, and for the most part is pretty hands-off, and if he needs to talk to you, you know, something's not quite right. But I kind of like the idea of, like, hey, man, I just listened to this. I didn't love this. Do this. Or that's cool. Like, I want instruction. I want coaching. And I think I'd be the same way as a player. I would prefer the Brian Kelly style. I don't know. I'm 37 now. Yeah, I got kids and a mortgage. I don't think your average 19-year-old wants that. And I just wonder about that relatability in Kelly, who is a fantastic coach. There's no doubt about that. Like, that's the other thing in episode one I'm seeing is, like, every detail he cares about. When you're the coach of a 90-player program, how are you really stopping practice to yell at a linebacker about his technique on one play?
Yeah.
But that's what he's doing every play.
But, I mean, that's what made Nick Saban great, right? I mean, he was one of those kind of guys as well. So it's just, that's kind of the beauty of where college is and why it's so fun, is you got guys with different personalities where some guys are going to be more on you, some guys are going to be a little more lenient, and there's so many options to choose from that, okay, that's why fit is so important. You might not be able to handle LSU. Okay, fine. Then go to South Carolina. You might not need that at South Carolina. Maybe you need a little more hard coaching. Go to LSU. That's the beauty of choosing that college, and why, you know, I think some of what the transfer portal is for is to make sure, like, ooh, I can't handle Brian Kelly. I got to go somewhere else. That's totally fine. But when it just becomes about, hey, I'm going to go get paid more, that's where the issues come in.
Would you even want to coach right now in college football? I don't. Or in
would
college,
I?
College sports in general.
No chance.
Me either. Now, these guys get paid a ton. I didn't look up Kelly's contract, but last night as I'm watching, I looked up Beamer's, and I think he's making like $8 million a year. I mean, they're making second contract NFL money at these universities.
$10 million.
For Kelly?
Or no, excuse me. $9.5 million. 10-year deal worth $95 million.
See, I would have thought it was more than that. Success he had at Notre Dame. Beamer only makes $1 million less. That's really strange to me.
Beamer's thought of pretty highly. He's going to have a good team this year, too.
He is, but Brian Kelly is a star, and he's, you know, they lured him away, essentially, from Notre Dame. But
I think
I'd do it because of the money. I mean, of course, but I'm thinking as a coach, not like Grant Paulson leaving the radio booth to go coach. But if I was a guy, I think I'd be more inclined like a Saban or one of these dudes. I just know this. If you're at the top level in the SEC, you're okay. My buddies that are into coaching in all sports at lower conferences are mostly miserable.
Yeah.
Because they're recruiting players, like their entire life mm-hmm. is just trying to convince a kid to come. And then you have to recruit your own players. If the player, let's look at low-level baseball as an example. Not even low-level. If you coach at George Washington University here or George Mason University or whatever, God forbid the guy that you go get that nobody else wanted comes to your place, has an awesome season, that's the best and worst thing that could ever happen. Because now he's leaving.
Yeah.
You're trying to just beg and plead with him to stay. You're not only recruiting for the next group, you're recruiting your own guys. And if you actually coach him a little too hard, or you annoy him because you bench him to send the message after he didn't run out of ground ball, maybe that's the time he decides, okay, well, I'm going somewhere else. No thanks. It's like teaching right now with most parents. Now, I got a lot of buddies that are teachers. I wouldn't want to be a teacher right now.
Yeah, it's difficult because you think about how programs used to be, just, again, back to the North Carolina-Duke rivalry thing, where you look at Duke and college basketball, they used to bring in a lot of one-and-dones, and they were refreshing, but they always had a lot of talent, whereas North Carolina, they'd get some big-time guys, but they were built more so on having a continuity of year after year after year. Think of the Baycotts being there and the Tyler Hansbrough and the guys like that that are there for all 4 years, and so you can't really do that as much anymore because you're not only recruiting new guys to bring into your system, like you're saying, but you're also trying to recruit your own guys that are already here. I have to be careful how I coach you, because next thing I know, you're at Michigan State next year. You're hanging out at Alabama next year. It's a weird spot to be in college sports, where every single year you're having to worry about this year, but also being careful about what could happen next year if I coach a guy too hard. It's just weird.
I wanted to go to the movies and see Fantastic Four this week. It's not happening. There's just too much stuff already available to me at home.
So much good stuff at home right now. So
I'm already
good.
Paying for the apps. I can't throw more money down to go to the theater and eat some popcorn. All right, next, I want to get into practice with the Patriots today, some of the storylines that came out of the session, who shined, who didn't. And Toby and I, behind the scenes the last couple of days, have been debating which offensive rookie we'd buy stock in going into their first season in D.C., of the camp standouts, Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt in the backfield or Jalen Lane at receiver. We're on different sides of this. We're going to ask that question. It'll be our poll of the day. And we're just getting popping here. Danny's out. Toby's in. I'm Grant. You're listening to The Fan. Back live from our Navy Yard studios on Half Street, Southeast DC. Grant and Danny coming your way on The Fan. Danny's out, Toby's in. Appreciate everybody hanging out with us. The Commanders hit the road today. They went to Foxborough to tangle with the Patriots in a practice that obviously led to skirmishes because it was a practice between two teams. And if you're allowed to fight and there are no ramifications or repercussions, you are going to fight. But seems like nothing overly serious happened. I did see that Mike Vrabel got into the middle of the fight and somehow ended up at the bottom of the pile. I think he was separating. He wasn't like pulling a manager trying to fight people, but he ends up getting cut up a little bit, had a little blood. Mike Vrabel still has that dog in him.
100% does. I can't believe he wasn't the coach right away when Belichick got fired, but now it just feels right because he always felt like a Patriot head coach. Whenever Belichick was done, I was thinking about it the other day. I was like, yeah, Vrabel, Patriots coach. It just seems right.
My guess is he waited for this gig. And if it wasn't this gig, it'd be the right gig. Now, the Patriots had an opening last year and I believe had already filled it before he got fired. Regardless of whether that timing is correct or not, they had essentially already promised the job to Gerard Mayo. He ended up showing almost immediately that he was overmatched and just didn't belong. And as the year went on,
who could have seen that coming?
Became more and more obvious. But the upgrade for them as a head coach is huge. I was just telling Ryan this. He couldn't believe this. The Patriots are favored in 10 games right now in look-ahead lines. Now, that's very different than whether or not they're going to win 10 games. I think the over-under for them, odds makers have, is like 7.5. But I do think they'll be frisky, and I do like them to go over that number. Drake May, as one of the youngest starters as a rookie over the last couple of years in the league last season, was actually really good and is only getting better, and they added some talent on offense, and they had a great offseason defensively. We can get into some of their personnel in a second. But the big difference is Vrabel, who is a culture changer. But to that point with him getting to the bottom of the pile to pull people apart and coming out with a little blood on his face, I mean, if there is a battle royale between 32 coaches in the NFL, like, he's one of the guys, I think, going in who's got to be high-seeded.
I think the final two is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's probably Vrabel and Dan Campbell, right?
Campbell's the favorite. I mean, he's definitely the defending champion. I think a guy like Sean McVay, who's like smaller and squatty, but definitely lifts a lot of weights, he might be able to handle his own. Dude, a D-lineman like Dan Quinn, all he talks about is like, let's get it on, and let's go out there, and let's beat some, you know what, like, cursing all the time. I think he could probably be okay, too.
I mean, he'd be scrappy, but I don't know. There's a difference with Mike Vrabel and with Dan Campbell. Those two are a little bit, they're a little crazy.
I agree with that. So here was some of what we learned today, some of the reports that came out of practice from the folks that were there. So we have wondered a lot about this corner room and this secondary because it's actually had a really good training camp. You and I have been out there a lot. My biggest takeaway after my first few practices I watched was, A, they're doing a lot more man coverage than I remember them doing last year early in camp, and B, they look way better in man coverage, and maybe that's not a coincidence. You know, last year they probably knew, we can't run a lot of man, we're going to run more zone. Well, now they feel like with Marshon Lattimore on one side and Trey Amos, the rookie second rounder who looks the part and has had a really good camp on the other, and then going and getting Jonathan Jones and sliding guys down the depth chart like Noah Igbinoghene, still having Mikey Sanders still in both the inside and outside roles, but now with a year of experience, you know he's really good. The room has gone from bad to pretty good on paper, but this great camp that they were having is possibly a product of the fact that their receiver room without Terry McLaurin isn't good. And today, the results seemingly were not nearly as good as they have been going up against Washington's wide receivers. Now, I did see that Trey Amos had some really nice plays and handled the zone, and that John Kime specifically pointed out that he thought today was another building block for feeling like he's going to be ready in week one to not only start, but actually help them a lot. So that's great. But I saw, just as a number, and I'm not a big training camp numbers guy, but Drake May, 11 on 11 today, was 10 of 12 with a drop from DeMario Douglas. Would have been 11 of 12 throwing the ball, moving the ball seemingly with ease through the air. So we were wondering, what does it look like when you go up against the receiver room? It's not like the Patriots have a great one.
If you just look through theirs, it's Stephon Diggs, DeMario Douglas apparently had a really good day, Kyle Williams, Kayshon Booty, Kendrick Bourne, Mac Hollins. Like, that's a bunch of Jags aside from Stephon Diggs.
And Diggs is no longer Stephon Diggs either.
Correct.
I mean, he's like the B version of Stephon Diggs. But regardless, that receiver group, it sounds like, did a better job than Washington secondary in that matchup today, for what it's worth. But all I cared about really was, what does Trey Amos look like? And supposedly he had a good day. So that's a win for me.
Yeah, I think overall this was a good practice for the guys. It sounded like the Washington offense did well. It sounded like the Patriots offense did well, which kind of sounds like you would expect, right? I mean,
I saw Laremy Tunsil apparently at times was not only a standout, but even dominated some reps.
Yeah, he was one of the guys that apparently almost caused a fight, taking one of the linebackers into the stands, something like that. But yeah, it's good to hear, right? Because I think that's something that we've talked about a little bit, but seeing it in action where you're going up against another squad, not like their pass rush is great, but I actually think that their offensive line this year could be more of a weapon, whereas in the past, it's kind of been something that's like, can they overcome the O-line? This year, I think that O-line can be something that you can bank on, hopefully in the run game, also in the passing game, and hopefully that opens stuff up, regardless of what the weapons on the outside end up being, whether Terry comes back or not. I think that's going to help out a ton, because you just haven't had a good O-line in quite some time.
When Sam Cosmi comes back, who's working on the side field still, and he's on PUP, I think their line, to your point, has a chance to actually be the best it's been here in several years. Now, to do that, to get there, Josh Connerly, their first-round pick out of Oregon, has to supplant Andrew Wiley at right tackle and then has to play at a high level. Because I think if Wiley's your right tackle, then you're still going to be somewhat middling because he's pedestrian. No longer the problem that I felt like in year one at times that he was, but Wiley is fine. You'd like to do better than fine after drafting a tackle in the first round. But a Tunsil left tackle, Coleman kicked inside to guard. I think you could see a Cosmi trajectory to his career where he was actually better than Cosmi at tackle, in my opinion. But okay last year at tackle as a rookie, as a third rounder. Now you kick him inside, a little bit easier role. He immediately becomes a fringe Pro Bowler, hopefully, in the next couple of years. Biotish at center is very stout. You know what you're getting out of him. Top half the league starter. Cosmi comes back at right guard, eventually going to play in a Pro Bowl. And then at right tackle, if Connerly's the real deal, you really don't have much to worry about for the next couple of seasons. And you've got depth with guys like Nick Allegretti, who was a full-time starter for you last season, who's now just waiting in the wings.
Yeah, and I think when you look at it too, if you can get to a point where whether it's Wiley that has to start right away or it is Connerly can get to a point where you can trust them a little bit. Kingsbury was talking about having Tunsil on the left side, not feeling like you have to chip. Okay, well, now you can move that guy over to the right side if you still need to help. But ideally, if you can get to a point where you can trust your bookends a little bit so that they can get things done without having to always chip and help, suddenly that's another guy out in the route. That's another way that you can have an outlet quick if there's a blitz or something you didn't see coming. And that just improves everything. That just makes everything so much better when you can have tackles that you can trust. And they haven't had that, especially on both sides, in quite some time.
One other joint practice observation that I saw and made note of to bring up, it was, I believe, Nikki Javala of The Athletic who said this. But she pointed out that today it was really clear that they missed Terry McLaurin in the red area, especially, where those windows get a little bit tighter and the coverage gets a little bit stickier. And that was where I think Daniels, who had a pretty good practice today, threw a pick on a ball in a small window that got picked off. He had an interception in the practice in Ashburn where he threw a ball just a hair behind Chris Moore on his back shoulder. And if it's Terry, he hauls it in and goes to the ground or probably turns it upfield. But Moore, who's just not on that level, ends up having the ball plucked out of his hands and off his shoulder by Amos. And I bring that up only to say that's multiple times where we've kind of seen this in these small areas where those contested catches, that's where Terry's your maven. You know, that is where he is going to butter his bread. And apparently today, from what Nikki pointed out, she said, you know, he doesn't have a lot of leverage, but practices like today and the more work that they get when they're playing, if they're playing in any of these exhibition games with starters, that will help him some. Because each time they're on the field as ones against ones without Terry McLaurin, it will become more obvious how much they miss him.
Yeah, I think if they don't ultimately get this done, we're going to have to go back and take a whole look at this offseason again. Because if you didn't prepare to not have a true wide receiver one, then you screwed up everything. You know, do you need Javon Kinlaw or should you have gotten a wide receiver one? Did you need Jonathan Jones or take your pick of where you could save a few bucks or should you have traded him before the draft or all this stuff? We can reevaluate. Should you have taken a receiver at 29 instead of Josh Connerly? If they ultimately don't get this done, you're going to have to go back and evaluate everything because, yes, you got Debo and we've talked about that wide receiver room having Debo. We think that Jalen Lane's going to have a good year. But then outside of that, it is a bunch of guys that you can't really trust. And I think another thing, too, is you've seen more interceptions this training camp than you did all of last year for Jaden Daniels in training camp. I think you're seeing that because Jaden is a little more willing to push the ball down the field, be a little more aggressive, throw into those tight windows. And if he doesn't have wide receivers that he can trust in those spots, then what the heck is he going to do? He's going to have to get back to, I'm throwing it underneath. And he's got an O-line now where he can actually push the ball and push the envelope a little bit. And so maybe that aggression is going to turn into a few more turnovers, but maybe increases the explosiveness of the offense. But if he doesn't have the guys to do it, then it really doesn't matter.
He's Toby Altizer in for Danny Ruye. I'm Grant Paulson. You're listening to G&D. We've been having a behind-the-scenes feud here during the breaks. Toby and I have actually stopped talking over this. It's a blood feud.
Correct.
And we want to get you guys to weigh in on this as we continue our poll of the day. You can buy stock in one of the offensive rookies who has stood out in camp, Merritt or Lane, the back or the receiver. We will get to that as we continue next on The Fan. And Danny should be back Monday, I believe. Assuming he's not too jet-lagged, coming back from Scotland.
So you need to come back with a kilt and some bagpipes?
This is his second Scotland trip in about a year and a half.
So I'm a little jealous.
He's one trip away, I think, from the kilt and the bagpipes. Your boy's on a heater, so I'm playing a little Mr. Dad in the mornings. The baby keeps the wife up, nursing like all night long every few hours, right? She's got to go into the other room and leave. Every now and then I wake up and I'm like, oh no, the baby's crying. But that's kind of the extent of my waking up for the most part. But mornings, I got to get the other three up and I got to do a bunch of stuff. And so today, for the second straight day, I made Dad McMuffins.
Okay? Ooh.
These are breakfast sandwiches and these hands here, these hands on the 106.7 The Fan YouTube high definition stream. There's no hands that make better scrambled eggs than these. Okay, that's the specialty. I've realized. If you would have asked me a month ago, what's the thing you make best? I don't know that I would have been able to answer. I used to bake some brownies, follow the box. Maybe that's the answer. Scrambled eggs. I had the perfect zero break, like full sheet on the pan, sliced to fit the roll, just perfect. You know, when you heat the pan just perfectly, oil, put the eggs, a little milk in the eggs, some salt, pepper, and then you use the spatula to kind of fold it over. I want you to think of your scrambled eggs like, kind of like an omelet almost, just a sheet one over the other. None of this people that like break up their eggs and have a bunch of chunks. You go to like a a breakfast at a hotel. That's the most disgusting thing ever to me is when you put a...
Really?
When you put a... Not like eating at a hotel. I mean, when you put a pile of eggs on your plate and it's like 100 little chunks, like ice
cubes.
That's fine. That's disgusting. Your eggs should be connected. They should be one big, unbroken... Like, my wife will just start jabbing the eggs with a spat.
That's
like, no, what are we doing here?
That's fine. But it doesn't go well in a sandwich. So, to your credit, if you're able to get that perfect fold...
You know what my son said today? He said, Dad, you make the best breakfast sandwiches in the world.
Wow, that probably felt really good.
I mean, I was like ready to open a restaurant. Emerald Lagasse over here.
I like it. I like it.
I'm on a bit of a heater, man. Before we get back to the Commanders, I want to talk about our poll of the day. We'll do that in a minute. How bad are the Nationals right now? This is gross, man. So Tobes and I were at the game yesterday side by side, shoulder to shoulder in the press box. There were a few thousand fans there as well. I think they announced about 18, something like that.
I think it was 20, but
God
I'll take
bless
the under.
You people. In the first inning of that game, they're down 5-0. Mackenzie Gore had his worst start of the season. He had to be tipping pitches, I thought. He was just getting crushed.
Something.
Like, recently, he has pitched poorly. He's now allowed 6 or fewer earnings in 3 of his last 4 starts post-All-Star break. But in most of those outings, he has not really had control or thrown the ball over the plate. He's walked a bunch of guys. 0 walks and a high strike rate in this game.
Yeah, and no strikeouts.
Didn't miss bats. They were on everything. It kind of felt like they had something, I thought. But regardless, he's just been brutal since the All-Star break. Ace of the staff. ERA has gone from 2.87 5 starts ago to well over 4 now, like 4.20 at this point. But they're down 5-0 in the first, and he finally gets an out in the first inning, and we get Bronx cheers at Nats Park.
It's so rough.
It is gross what has happened. I don't remember a stretch this bad. They used to lose 100 games a year like clockwork. I don't remember it being like this. Toby, 6 losses in a row. On this homestand, 4 straight. It's just been uncompetitive. They have allowed 70 runs and 103 hits over 6 games. Think about that. That is an average, quick math here, of 11-plus runs and like 17 hits per game for a week. Twice in this 6-game losing streak, they've given up 16 runs and 24 hits in a game or more. And, oh, by the way, just for good measure, just a little icing on the cake, they've committed 8 errors in their last 5 games. Throwing the ball into center field as guys are trying to steal. Like, this is... I lied to you guys. I said that this weekend was rock bottom. 106.7, the Fan put out a big graphic about it. The Nationals were real happy about it, by the way. I lied, okay? I lied about that. Nationals, I apologize. I was wrong. This weekend wasn't rock bottom. You're right, I shouldn't have said that. This is rock bottom, okay? This is The Rock doing this with his arms, throwing the elbow pad into the crowd, getting ready to drop the people's elbow on somebody's candy ass. This is rock bottom. This is brutal.
Yeah, it's not very good at all. Matter of fact, walking back from the game yesterday, I walked into our building here as I was going to the garage, and someone else had parked there. It was like a family of 4. A dad, his mom, with
Before
2 kids. No, after the game. Oh. And I just wanted to be like, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it was before the game. Just start yelling, like, don't do it! Don't do it! Don't do it to these kids! Turn around! Go home!
The only saving grace is the kid who's probably like 8 years old, looked like he got a baseball. So at least there was something. Otherwise, watching that product right now is just so difficult. And to the credit of the Nationals, at least in the 9th inning, they decide to show up when they're down by 12 runs.
Oh, they're good for that.
And they put together some good at-bats then. But the first 8 innings, not so much.
There is nobody better in baseball than the 9th inning. We're going to keep on chugging along. We're going to give you a few runs when we're down by a bunch. The bit earlier in the year, which I miss, this was fun.
Yeah.
They used to get the tying run to the plate in every single game that they lost. So, like, they would be down 4, they'd get a run in and 2 on, and the tying run would come to the plate. And they were Davey's scrappy little Nats. Which, by the way, I'm not saying they shouldn't have fired Davey or, you know, what have you, but he had to have been just belly laughing last night, wherever he
well,
was.
You know what? It's funny because you get to the point in the game where it is so far out of hand. You know what I was rooting for last night, Grant? I was rooting for Max Schumann of the A's to get a base hit. By the way, everyone else in the lineup had a hit. He was 0-for-6. Can't feel good to be Max Schumann today. But I needed him to get a hit because then Shea Langeliers could come to the plate looking for his 4th homer of the game. That's what I was looking for because nothing else on the other side mattered.
That's how you know it's bad. You're in the ballpark. As a Nats fan, you're like, hopefully we get one more shot for the A's guy to hit his fourth home run. That's what you're rooting for last night. Shai Langeliers, who the Nats really liked ahead of the draft when he went 11th overall to the Braves. I remember before the draft them saying like that was one of their favorite guys. I don't remember where they picked that year. Probably behind that and took some guy that didn't get to the big leagues. But they were Langeliers guys. He just didn't make his way down to the Nats. I don't have a problem with anything they did at the deadline. I told you guys, I actually think they did a really good job. I think DeBartolo had a good deadline. But it did clear a path to whatever this is at this moment. Intriguing storyline tonight. They might be few or far between here in short order, but you've got Cade Cavalli making his season debut, the former first-round pick. Is he a long-term member of this rotation? Does he end up ultimately in the bullpen? Can he fight his way back into being a piece moving forward? I mean, everybody's moved on from him at this point because it's been 3 years since he started. And you know how fans are now, right? I mean, Mackenzie Gore is at a point in his situation where he's had a bad month, basically. And people are like, are we sure he's any good? Like, if that's what we're doing, then with Cade Cavalli, you've got to assume that people have now just decided he's never going to be anything in the big leagues. But Cade Cavalli still got something to say about that.
Yeah.
He's going to be able to get the last word in on that. He's still got really good stuff. Still throws 97 miles an hour. So I'll be excited to see him make his debut tonight. But next, let's get to our poll of the day and a conversation about a couple of these standout young Commanders on the offensive side of the ball. You're listening to Grant and Danny on The Fan.